Good morning. We're going to continue our series here on the Psalms of Ascent, these Psalms from 120 to 134, 15 Psalms that are songs of pilgrimage that are going to lead us up to our time of pilgrimage as we go out to Youth Front Camp South. Before we get into that, though, I want to just kind of mention two brief things kind of as way of a preface. The first one is this. This last week at camp, we had the little tykes out at Camp South, grades 3rd to 5th grade. And so if you come up and see me and there's this little thing on my neck, it looks like a hickey. It's not. What happened is with the little kids, we don't let them shoot paintballs at each other. But because we're idiots, we let ourselves run around and have them shoot paintballs at us. So because none of the cabin leaders whom I supervised were willing to do it, I said, I'll do it. So I went out there and got shot in the neck. Someone's objecting that they did it. I got shot in the neck by this little 8-year-old girl. And we get back in the safe zone where they can't shoot. And I'm like, so who shot me? And this little girl looks up at me. She's literally about this tall. I did. And so I go, oh, that was a great shot. And she goes, yeah, I know. I was aiming for your head. So, you know, ruthless out there at South. So it's not a hickey. Then more seriously, this is the last Sunday in the interim period for Tom and myself. And Tom mentioned last week just what a privilege it was for him to be a part of this community in this way as one of the interim preachers. And I echo those sentiments. It's been an absolute honor and an absolute privilege to be able to do that. And I've shared a little bit about my own story and my own background, but not a ton. And so just to sort of illustrate God's faithfulness, just share real briefly about what this process and what this time has been for me. When I went to seminary, I went there with the intention of being an egghead and going straight through and getting my doctorate and becoming a professor of theology. And I met some friends there that spoke God's call into my life in a different way. And I decided that wasn't necessarily the course for me, that I needed to go be a youth pastor or be a pastor, be in a church. And so I took a call at a church in Minnesota and discovered this love for unpacking the scriptures and preaching and just being a teacher in that way that I didn't know necessarily that I had within me. And the long story there, I was only there a year because it was a really bad fit and it was a really hard environment. And I think I could have stayed and been one of these kind of divisive figures. And I just decided that wasn't faithful for us. Amy and I talked a lot about that. And so we decided to resign, and we didn't have a place to go. We resigned and trusted God in that was the right move, to submit to the leadership of the church in that way. And then Mike King talked to me about coming down here, and I had some other interests from some other churches, but we felt like Youth Front was the place we needed to go. And so we came to Kansas City, but one of the things that I was just grieved about in that process was that I would be doing kind of pastoring outside of the local church, and knowing that I may not get a chance again to do much preaching and to do much teaching of the scriptures in this way. And so So we came here, and there's still a lot of healing that needed to happen for me in particular. And this community has been that for me. And then I'm just blown away at God's faithfulness, that I come to Kansas City thinking like this is a part of me that I have to give up in order to follow God's call. And I get here, and you guys as a community are just part of God's faithfulness to me to be able to do this and to do this for the last 6 months with you. Along with Tom. And so I just say from the depths of my soul, thank you for letting me be a teacher in this congregation, even for just 6 months. You have, maybe you're discovering, but you have absolutely no idea what that has meant for my sense of call and a sense of affirmation that God has me in the right place. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. No. So Psalm 126, let's go there. We're gonna continue this series. We're gonna read this psalm. It's a short psalm, a to-the-point psalm, and just a beautiful song of prayer on the way of pilgrimage. So as we always do, let's read it together, and then I invite you to reflect on it out loud with me afterwards. So let's read together. Psalm 126, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy. Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. Those who go out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them. So what thoughts do you guys have on this passage? Yeah, James. Yeah. 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 Thanks, James. James said that the goodness of this psalm is that no matter what situation, whether it's a dark situation or a good situation, that it's all about following Jesus and being on a journey with him. Thanks, James. Who else? Yeah. Yeah, the comment was that this psalm is like the epitome of community, that when Zion is prospering, everything is prospering, that we're all sort of together, yoked together. Good. Yeah, the comment is on this line about we were like those who dreamed, that like it's almost too good to be true, and here it is, and it turns into these songs of laughter and joy. Good. A couple more.
I like the contrast between sowing in tears and weeping in joy.
Yeah.
The importance that of acting in faith is, even though the faith isn't necessarily there at the time.
Yeah, yeah, the comment is that like we sow out in tears and we reap in joy, that faith is sort of entering into that contrast and trusting that there will be good things that come from it. Good.
I like the way it concentrates on songs of joy and not being happy, and how we tend to always want to be happy.
Yeah.
Happy's not even in there, it's joy.
Yeah. Yeah, the comment is about the difference between joy, like there's something about being rooted in joy versus sort of this fleeting sense of happiness that's more of a feeling-based kind of thing. Good. One more. Right here. Yeah, the comment, very simply, if we don't go out, we can't return. That there's something about taking that step. Dave, we'll go one more, Dave. Say it again. Yeah. Yeah, great comment. That this sowing in tears and then reaping back in joy, that there's labor to it, that there's work, there's something good about expending, sort of doing that and putting ourselves out in that way, embracing it. Great comments. All of them will be touched on in implicit ways, some of them more explicitly than others. To begin with, though, as we look at this psalm and we hit on it, especially in the comments around joy, joy is at the center of this psalm. This psalm is, its heartbeat is in joy, even in the passages where it talks about reaping or sowing in tears and going out with weeping. It's still, joy is sort of that constant refrain that goes through this psalm. Eugene Peterson, who wrote the book Along Obedience in the Same Direction, which is what we're using to help guide us as we go on pilgrimage during this time. He writes that joy is characteristic of Christian pilgrimage. In other words, what he's saying is at the heart of the Christian life is this joy. There's joy in discipleship. There's joy in journeying with God in Jesus Christ. That the existence of Christians is one that is marked by a kind of joyfulness. And Peterson unpacks that to talk about laughter and gladness and goodness. And that's this deep sense of joy. But if you're like me, when you hear a comment like that, or you hear a statement like that that's that assertive and sort of that to the point, you maybe ask the question like I do, well, what about those folks then who aren't feeling joyful right now? What about them? Is there something deficient in their understanding of the Christian life? Is there something wrong with them as Christians? And I think this psalm teaches us how to respond to that question, because I think it's a natural question. And I think Peterson's right, and I think what this psalm is going to help us do is understand joy in maybe a different way. But I think Peterson's right, because if you think back to 3 weeks ago when we talked about going up to Jerusalem on pilgrimage, making that trip, and we talked about these ideas of shalom and shalvah, shalom being the sense of peace, but really what's meant by that is the idea that life is put back together, that life is put to rights. And that in that, there's this thing, shalvah, that emerges, which is a sense of prosperity or a sense of security in the fact that God is working on our behalf, that God is here, that God is at work, and we are safe in and among a people that are journeying together where God is found. That is, if that is what pilgrimage is about, if that is what the Christian life is about, is shalom and shalvah, then joy is naturally an expression of that. Joy comes out of that. And so I think Peterson's right. But see, the problem, the question still remains, the question still resonates for me. And the problem, though, is not with the folks who are feeling like joy is hard right now. The problem is not with them. And the problem is also not with this idea that maybe the Christian life then is just completely unrealistic. The problem instead is with our understanding of joy. And even when we don't think about it in terms of feelings or in terms of happiness, we still often equate joy with a work that we do. We often think of joy as something that we have to muster up within ourselves, something that we have to attain, something that we have to try really hard at to get. But this psalm is going to teach us something. It's going to deconstruct that mindset. It's going to deconstruct that idea for us and lead us to something that's vastly more hopeful, vastly more wonderful than that, and I think vastly more freeing. And it's basically this, and they tell you not to give away the punchline, but I'm going to. It's basically this, that joy is not a work that we do, but it is a consequence of God's grace at work in our lives. It is the byproduct of a God who acts with and for us. And that understanding of joy is what is at the heart of this prayer, at the heart of this psalm. And that is the kind of joy that these pilgrims, these Hebrew people that sang these songs on pilgrimage, were experiencing and singing about and proclaiming as they went out. That understanding of joy, that it is a consequence of God's work in our lives. To get at this idea that comes out in this psalm, I want to talk about the concept of story. Because story is at the heart of this psalm. This psalm is a psalm that is about joy, but it's rooted in stories. Alistair MacIntyre was a 20th century philosopher, might still be alive, so he is a 20th century philosopher. But he writes about, he does a lot with ethics, and he talks about, basically his point is this, that if you want to know what someone's about, if you want to know what it is that they will do, if you want to know who they are, then you have to know the story that frames their life. You have to understand the story that gives shape to the way that they view the world. You have to understand the story that shapes them. And everybody's all, you know, up in arms about MacIntyre, and they're all overwhelmed at like how brilliant this is and what a great insight, and you know, this whole new postmodern insight kind of thing. And the reality is he just stole it from the Hebrews. They were the people of Israel, the people, God's people, were a storied people. They lived their life out of a story that at the heart of it was contained in the idea that God is at work on their behalf in their history, that God is a God in history working on their behalf. And so what they did to communicate their identity as God's people, to communicate the things that really mattered, to teach their kids what it meant to live as God's people is, they told stories. And so they talk about being their God being the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is not just a reference of identity, it's a reference to story. When they say that, they say, the God of Abraham. See, and then they would say, so Abraham, right, kids, was this old guy. And he had a wife named Sarah, and she was barren. But then one day, this God, who's a little bit ridiculous, shows up to him and says, hey, Abraham, I'm going to bless you with more offspring than there are sand on the seashores, and more offspring than there are stars in the sky. I'm going to make of you a great nation, and all of the other nations will be blessed through your offspring. And then what happens? Well, Abraham does a little bit of stuff, but God stays faithful to his promise and blesses them with the child Isaac. God intervenes. God breaks in. God does something and begins to write a story, and he blesses them with Isaac. And then later on, Abraham takes this child of promise, this child through whom the rest of the world is going to be blessed, and he takes him up a hill to sacrifice him because that's what God instructed him to do. And Abraham's probably marching him up there going, I don't know what's going to happen. And Isaac, a very perceptive young lad, says, hey, Dad, where's the ram? And Abraham's response is, God will provide. And sure enough, they get up there, Isaac's on the altar, Abraham's about to follow through in this absurd moment of faith, and his hand is stopped by the Lord, and there's a ram in the thicket that they then sacrifice, and Isaac becomes a part of this story of God intervening in these people's lives. And then Jacob, son of Isaac, driven out to the wilderness where he wrestles with God, where he contends with God, and in this battle, God gives him battle, that's maybe a little strong. In this wrestling match, in this contention, Jacob is given a new name, Israel, where God essentially says, you will be my people and I will be your God, reaffirms that and tells this story. And then they say, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the God of Moses. And so they end up, the Hebrews end up in Egypt through Joseph, if you know that story with the big, you know, pretty coat and all that stuff. If you know that story, they end up in Egypt and things are good for a little while, but then this empire starts to enslave and oppress and exploit them and starts to build their empire on the backs of these people, so much so that what they're really trying to do is beat this story out of them so that they forget about their God. And the older generation is still trying to tell these stories and explain and keep this identity intact. And the young folks are maybe starting to go, maybe this is all just a bunch of fairy tales. Maybe this is really just a little bit of a folk tale. And then Moses. And just as the stories are maybe beginning to slip away, just as their history, just as the promise and the joy of God who works in their history is about to sort of slip out of their collective consciousness, they find themselves on dry ground with water on both sides as they're being led out by their God into the promised land. And there's countless stories throughout their history that give shape to who these people are. Countless stories of God intervening on their behalf. Telling stories, so they tell stories of restoration. And what it is they see that God has written God's story through their own. And it's this that gives shape to their joy. And that's what's happening in this psalm. Quite clearly, these stories, the stories that we've been talking about and others, are the occasions for joy in this psalm. So the joy that they proclaim and sing about as they are on pilgrimage, the joy that they remind themselves of is that they are rooted in a God who has acted on their behalf in history. Their joy is found in that, a God who has done great things for them, a God who has restored their fortune so much so that it seems like a dream, that it seems too good to be true that God could actually do this for us. And so what we see then about this idea of joy that's at work in this psalm and that's at work in and among the Hebrew mindset is that joy is about receptivity. It's not about working ourselves up to a place of being glad and happy. It's about being receptive to the work of God in our lives, the work of God on our behalf, the work of God that intervenes to restore us to goodness. And so because of that, joy is rooted not in us, it's rooted in who God is and what God has done. It's that consequence of being able to participate in what God is doing. And that's what's going on in the first half of this psalm as these people are on pilgrimage singing this song. And the image that I get as they're walking is this, that they're singing these songs and they sing about the restoration of Zion. And there's just great gladness in this song. And the image I get, because I have a 3-year-old son and a 2-year-old daughter, is walking with my kids and Soren looking up at me or Svea looking up at me and going, "Daddy, tell me those stories again. Tell me the stories of when God restored our fortunes. Tell me those stories when it seemed too good to be true, those stories that you choke up over when you start to tell them." And whenever Soren asks me to tell him stories about Jesus from the Bible, I see in his eye a little bit of what that means. I see this glimmer of like, this is really amazing. And I think that's what's going on in this. And so they share these stories and they sing these songs to remind themselves of God's work in their history, God's work for their good, for their salvation, for their deliverance. And that is the joy that they share in this psalm. That is the joy that is theirs as a part of this song. But sharing in this joy, sharing in the joy of what God has done, is only half of the story in this psalm. It's only part of the fullness of joy that's in this. See, when they are sharing in this story of these stories of joy and how God has worked on their behalf, what they're also doing is anticipating what God will do in the future. And that's the second half of this song. Peterson writes this, that joy in this psalm is joy that is built from the past and yet borrows from the future. It's joy that's built from the past of what God has done intervening on them on their behalf and borrows from the future of what God will do. In other words, there's an overwhelming sense of faithfulness at who God is, that because God has restored our fortunes in the past, God is faithful to be who God is and do that again in the future. And that is what grounds not only our hope, but also our joy in that God. So God is both the God of history and the God of promise. God is the God of history and the God of promise. See, the sense here is that this God in whom our joy is located, there's no arbitrariness to the way that he deals with us. God is faithful to do again what God has always done. And so in the second half of this psalm, there's this switch of posture to this anticipation that God will do something again, that God will restore our fortunes again so that it seems too good to be true. Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev, this very dry region. Peterson translates it as bring water to our drought-stricken lives. So that those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. So that those who go out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them. In other words, they'll go out weeping and they'll come back overflowing with joy. See, as the Hebrew people would make pilgrimage, they weren't unique in the fact that they took pilgrimage. There were tons of other religious groups and tons of other national groups that made pilgrimage. But the way that they made pilgrimage, these other groups, was that it was very based on the calendar. It was based on planting seasons. It was based on harvesting seasons. And the activity of God was sort of located in those moments of harvesting and reaping and sowing. And what this psalm does is it says, though we make pilgrimage in the same way, our God is not bound by this calendar. Our God has a different understanding of time. Our God is somebody who works in and on our behalf at all times, in all places. In any moment, time is ripe for God's activity. Time is pregnant with God's activity. Kairos time. Instead of chronos time, time where God can break in and explode open our understanding of what he's doing, can again break in and bring water to our drought-stricken lives. And pilgrimage was but a practice of that, that opened up our view of time. The idea that God would do something new with and for us. The idea that maybe on pilgrimage and maybe at other times, God will break in and restore our fortunes so that we have a new story to tell. A new story to shape our identity. One filled with great joy because God is with and for us. And so as I have reflected on this psalm all week and thought about it, I come back to that question I asked at the beginning, well, what about those folks then in our community that are just struggling right now, whose lives aren't marked by joy? What about those folks that are here who are experiencing more of the second half of this song than they are the first? The part that says that they sow in tears, that we go out weeping, that there's more tears than joy or more sorrow than gladness. What about those folks? As we dig, as we've dug into this psalm, something became clear to me about what joy looks like for those of us that make our way with Jesus, that are on pilgrimage with Jesus, and this is what I love about it. God invites us to journey with him just as we are right now. Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. The assumption of the psalmist here is not that we have to move ourselves out of sorrow or move ourselves out of the place of hardship or the place where we're not joyful. The assumption instead is that we sow with our tears. So for some of us that are here, for us to practice joy this morning and maybe even to practice joy on pilgrimage is to sow our tears. And then to allow God to return them to us as joy. To discover the joy in a God who accepts our tears as a good and right seed for his joy. To discover a God who's with and for us and because of that also gives us to one another, to walk with and for one another. And so sometimes that joy that's characteristic of the Christian life that Peterson writes is not actually our joy, but it's the joy of this community. People who are willing to then stand in our place for us and to express joy from their mouth and maybe not our own. And for us to experience joy is to sow our tears and listen to the response, to the reaping of others in our lives. So if you're one of those people maybe this morning that's like, I'm just not joyful, it's hard to sing these songs of joy, it's okay, we can sing them for you. As we prepare to make pilgrimage, I'm excited to see the joy that is unleashed among us as we encounter God, as God is at work in our midst. And I'm excited to see the harvest of joy as part of this pilgrimage. Amen.